I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network. Today, I'm thoroughly delighted to have on the show Gordon Edgar, whose second book, Cheddar, has just come out. Welcome, Gordon.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
You're very welcome. Okay, this book, first of all, has a pretitle and a subtitle. Is that correct? Is that what you call them?
That is correct.
Is that what they're called?
I'll tell you something. Here's a little secret about book writing. I'm in charge of everything inside the covers, but everything outside the covers, including, you know, the cover illustrations and the titles and all that, you know, the publisher gets to decide that stuff. It's funny because the original title of the book was called United States of Cheddar.
Oh, I like it.
And but then my publisher realized that nobody had put out a book that was just titled Cheddar. So we just went for that, and then added the subtitles to kind of give people an idea of what might be inside. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that works.
What I'm calling the pre-title, which is above the title, is A Journey to the Heart of America's Most Iconic Cheese. But then what is the subtitle, which I think tells more of what the book is about, says, and what it can tell us about our history, cultural identity, and food politics.
Yeah, well, that's what it says. Hopefully it delivers, too.
I think it does.
I mean, I think that that cheddar's a really interesting topic to look into, and I feel like, as someone who's been in the cheese world for 20-plus years, it's something that we often overlook as cheese people because, you know, there's so many exciting things going on in the cheese world. But, you know, cheddar has really dominated American cheese making for so long, and it's something we take for granted. And I really think that when you kind of look into something that you otherwise take for granted, I feel like it can show a lot of really revealing things. And so it's kind of the mission of the book.
Okay, well, I have some questions about that. It's a very ambitious and interesting book. I know you talk in the book about how you got the idea, but can you tell us on the radio, when did you know there would be a second book?
I have to say, after writing the first book, when it came out, you know, you kind of think, if you write a book, you kind of think, oh, great, it's out, I'm kind of done.
Right.
But what I didn't realize was that I spent the entire whole next year, you know, basically working two jobs, which was my, you know, regular job at Rainbow Grocery, and then doing a full-time job trying
promoting
to promote
the book.
You know, traveling, doing cheese events, doing cheese classes. I did something like, I had probably nearly 50 events, all told after that. And I got to say, if you'd asked me in that year if I was going to write another book, I would have said, no way.
I'm done.
Because, you know, unless somebody was going to guarantee that it would, you know, provide a livable income for years, it was just, it was a lot. It was basically doing two jobs at once.
Right. And you're not paid for that second job.
I'm sorry?
You're not paid for touring and promoting.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, my publisher had a small amount of money to publicize the book, but most of that was out of pocket. And, I think that, the other thing about books like this, especially books on independent presses, is, if you want to make money, you should just work more at your regular job. Mm-hmm. You know, this is definitely more of a labor of love. But at some point after I was kind of done promoting the last book, I got the itch again, and I was trying to figure out, what was out there to be said that, other people handle doing the how cheese is made. Other people handle the coffee table books or the nice picture books. You know, it's just not my strength. So I said, what's something that I can look into that would be helpful to the cheese community that something I'm also interested in? And, I think that there's two things that really kind of spurred me on. One was visiting the Golden Giant in Wisconsin, which is was supposedly a replica of the world's largest cheese from the New York World's Fair that was made in Wisconsin. And I went, the story is better told in the book, but basically I went hundreds of miles out of my way with a friend
to go see the
monument to the Golden Giant. And, we got there, we're really excited. Well, I was really excited. My friend was humoring me. And, she does not work in the cheese business. And, we got there and, it's a beautiful trailer. It has the trailer that actually took the cheese to the fair. It's this mm-hmm. beautiful glass trailer that's refrigerated. But inside was just a wooden crate. That was it. It was like there wasn't even a styrofoam painted orange cheddar. I was like, this is the monument to cheddar.
Uh-huh.
Kind of in my head, and that was kind of one of the ways that it really mm-hmm. clicked for me was, cheddar kind of deserves some kind of monument, some mm-hmm. kind of mm-hmm. thing. And I'm not a monument builder, so I decided to work on a book about it.
So that's my next question was, when and why did cheddar get the call?
Well, if you look at the history of cheddar, and there's many different parts we can talk about, but the part that initially interested me was, if you look at in 1851, that's when cheddar started to become a factory-made cheese.
Mm-hmm.
1851, the Williams family in upstate New York and Rome, New York, they built what is usually called the first cheese factory, first cheddar factory. What it did is it started the trend to take cheese off the farm, make it a professional job, and kind of lead the way. And America's really good, especially at that time period, in making things go from artisan into factory production.
Mm.
The systematizing the make process, the cheese itself, all these things really led to it becoming, the first industrial cheese, in the United States, and really dominating the cheese market in the United States. I mean, for 150 years, cheddar was the most popular cheese
mm-hmm.
In this country. So to me, it seemed really like it was an obvious thing to look into. To really learn and talk more about our food system in general, as well as cheese in particular,
mm-hmm.
And also I love cheddar.
Right.
I mean,
right.
There's definitely that aspect to it. And I had some other mysteries to solve and things like that. But I think that was the impetus. How did we get to where we are in the cheese world these days?
Mm-hmm.
And cheddar seemed to be the answer.
Right. Well, just to fill people in who haven't even thumbed through the book yet, it includes, I'd say, excellent cheese history, food industry history, food politics, taste politics, probably your politics as well. Did you set out, did you know it was going to be so all-encompassing?
Well, I couldn't think of any other cheese that would be more encompassing.
More easily encompassing.
So I hoped, there were some things that I was, honestly, there was other parts that I couldn't even get into, partly for lack of time and partly because mm-hmm. they were a little more tangential. But it seemed to be something that, on the one level, pretty much everybody in the country, at one point or another has tried cheddar.
Right.
So it's something very relatable.
Eats it. Right.
But it's also something that's very much been mm-hmm. everywhere, so it could talk about a lot of things.
Right, right. How much research did you do on the road versus in books or on the internet?
I visited a number of places. I wish I could have visited more. I mean, there's so many places to visit, and there's so little money
mm-hmm.
in bookmaking,
Right.
I did some stuff off of, other cheese trips, but some I really did seek out to make trips. I would say, time-wise, the visiting of places, I probably spent over the last 3 years, maybe 2 or 3 months visiting places.
Uh-huh.
That might be a high estimate, but somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the reading was a constant thing.
Uh-huh.
That was something I spent much of my advance, the advance that I didn't spend traveling, I spent on buying out of print cheese books.
So. Now you have a lovely collection, I bet.
I do have a great collection now.
So maybe your next book can be found in those books, too.
It's possible. It's possible. I think I'm on an every 5 year schedule, okay. So I'll have to sit and think about what the next one will be.
What were your favorite parts to either research or write?
That's a good question. I think that, it's always, for me, more fun to talk about anecdotes. This funny thing where, I tell the story of where, this is something that was really shocking to me as someone who's, even though I've been involved in cheese for a long time, that, by the mid-late 1800s, the United States was exporting cheese. And exporting cheddar to England.
Now, that's one of my questions. It's amazing to me that we were exporting large amounts of cheddar to England. What started it? What stopped it?
Well, what started it was the industrial production, in America. There was also farm production that was getting exported to some extent. But, there was just a lot more cheddar being produced here, and there wasn't enough cheddar being produced in England to meet demand.
And they had not gotten to factory production?
No, I mean, England definitely, I mean, there was, I didn't really research that as extensively, but it was much slower to adapt, and, that made sense if you think of, a country that's already kind of established and another country that is continually expanding.
Right.
The reason that Wisconsin became a mass, cheddar mecca, was because, that originally Wisconsin was all wheat, and it was too much monoculture. They ruined the soil in the 1800s, and they needed to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just happened to be the time that factory cheese production was kind of something to do, and that's what they did.
The
rest is history.
To fix the land.
But in terms of writing, the story, it's the United States was exporting all this cheddar to England, but some people got greedy, and they started doing what what's called filled milk cheese.
Ah, yes.
And that means you replace the butter fat with some kind of oil or oleo or something like that, which is a much cheaper way to produce it, but is also a much less good product. That kind of cheese making, that filled milk cheese, ruined the market for American cheese in England, and pretty much, to a large extent, ended the export market for U.S. cheese to Europe and England, until very recently when we've had a few of our best new smaller production cheesemakers, kind of exporting to fancy shops.
And that's been difficult. That hasn't been easy to do.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Right.
Absolutely not.
I mean, Europe in general does not want our cheese, it seems to me.
Well, yeah, but that's the historical reason for it.
It's seen as
low quality. I mean, I'm not sure if you asked somebody why they think American cheese would be low quality, they would know if they were in Europe. But, historically, you start a reputation like that, and it's really hard to...
Right.
To rebuild it.
So it was basically too processed. We were gypping them.
Yeah, we were definitely ripping them off a little bit. But the funniest part of the writing, the question you asked about that was that I thought I had used an anecdote. It's hard to remember sometimes because you write a lot and then you cut a lot.
Right.
And I thought I had put in this anecdote in the book about working the counter and being approached by this person trying to sell me filled milk cheese in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea at that point, not knowing the history of cheddar, not knowing the history of the export, cheese market, that this was a thing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I'd never even heard of what it was, and I didn't understand it. And kind of going back and just reliving that experience was hilarious, especially now that I kind of know the background of the cheese. And it was pretty much illegal in the United States for, it wasn't technically, but nobody was producing it for decades until it became legalized again in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there's not a real market for it. I mean, I don't know if anybody's making it these days.
Right. What were the hardest parts of the book to write or think about?
I think that on some level, the hardest part is always like thinking, oh, that's a really funny anecdote, but it might make somebody look bad,
Okay.
So I can't use it, even though it would be really funny.
Uh-huh.
But that's, you know, that's my own self-editing. But you know, I think the hardest part, honestly, I mean, the hardest part of writing is just reading something for the 15th, 20th time and trying to, like,
and going over it.
Going over it and just trying to make sure it makes sense, make sure it's coming across the way you want it to, and that it works. I wouldn't say there's any particular section that was harder than others. I would say that I'd say if I had to pick one, it was probably just the chapter where I try to address what is cheddar. Because I, you know, things have to get a little more technical in that chapter, and it's really easy as a non-scientist to make a mistake, you know, as a non-cheesemaker or a non-dairy scientist. You know, it's really easy to, like, mix up a couple things and then say something really dumb. So,
Well, I want the listeners to know that there are chapters about Wisconsin, Vermont, California, history, politics. There's everything in this book, really. I just reread the final chapters that you kind of get into your political stuff, which were excellent. But one small but giant example is what this book did for me was I was getting ready for the interview and I checked out the pictures of Henning's mammoth wheels online. And they're hilarious. They're gigantic. There's one that is 3,500 pounds.
Yeah, you know, and they still, you know, Henning's, I was just there 3 weeks ago.
Oh, cool.
You know, and we walked through their warehouse. And, you know,
how many of those do they have?
None that are quite that big,
okay.
You know, in stock right now. But, I mean, you tomorrow could order a 3,000-pound, you know, Henning's mammoth cheddar, you know, and it would take a little while to make it and age it, but...
Right, it did say wholesale only.
Yeah.
And
it's a special thing.
Right. And your
description... Cheese is special. People tend to like it.
Your description of when you first got the giant cheddar in your store long ago, and you're trying to figure out how to cut it...
Yeah, no, I think I said, you know, we were like a bunch of dudes sitting around pretending we knew how to fix a car, you know.
Uh-huh.
I was like, I don't know how to cut this thing.
Right.
And, you know, nothing in my cheese career has prepared me for knowing how to cut into and maintain a 500-pound cheddar until you sell it, especially if you want to put it on display.
Right.
And which, of course, is why you buy a mammoth cheddar.
Right.
You don't buy it to take up space in your backstock area.
Right.
And, you know, we figured out a way, but I can't say it was my proudest moment.
I think you should illustrate that with a video because it was hard to exactly imagine where the nails were going in the board and how you were turning it around to get the slice of cheddar. But anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, the only way we could figure out how to score the rind was to very lightly take, you know, a piece of wood, hammer a couple nails into it and break the plane. I mean, you know, it's funny because now, you know, I would think, oh, you know, clearly you'd score it, you know, maybe even with, like, you know, a Parmesan knife or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we didn't even have a Parmesan knife back then.
Right.
So, I mean, this was back in 1996 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, definitely I feel like the cheese world has made leaps and bounds since then in understanding how to care for cheese.
Mm-hmm. Do you know which aspects readers are finding the most interesting as you're touring about? Or are they mostly,
you know, I think
not having read it yet?
This kind of thing, you know, when I do readings and events, I always try to read the fun stuff.
Right.
Because it's just, you know, it just doesn't work trying to read either something with facts and figures or something really serious in that kind of setting. Because people, it's hard for them to keep concentrating on that.
Yes.
So I would say that some of the best advice I was given with the first book was treat your readings like it's like the DVD extras.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I read some fun things. I read like a poem that I didn't put in the book that's an ode on a mammoth cheddar by James McIntyre, which everybody loves that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that in terms of reading it, people respond to different things. I mean, I had somebody who interviewed me and for a newspaper, and they actually couldn't fit it in their story, but they were like, "Oh my God, your food politics chapter you know, it was one of the best I've ever read about this. And it's somebody who's working on those kind of issues, and it didn't really fit into the interview, but they were like, thank you, that was awesome.
Oh, good.
But other people are, you know, also just, you know, they like the cheese stories. They like the, you know, there's some stories like there were in the first book about just working the counter.
Right,
and, you know,
right.
cheese workers really appreciate those.
Right. So. Well, it's super educational, but fun. And your impish voice comes through. We have to take a break. So we'll be right back on Cutting the Curd with Gordon Edgar talking about cheddar.
Cider Week helps to bring profitability to local orchards while reviving heirloom apple varieties by cultivating awareness of craft cider. Cider Week connects cider makers from New York State and select pioneering guest cideries outside the state to buyers from top restaurants, bars, and retail shops across New York City. Those culinary tastemakers, in turn, help increase consumer awareness of cider's pleasures by hosting public events, tastings, dinners, classes, and pairings that build appreciation and demand for regional ciders.
The Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, it's Diane Stemple back on Cutting the Curd with Gordon Edgar. Gordon, are you back?
I'm here.
Okay, great. Well, interestingly enough, my next question is about Wisconsin, and we just had an ad about how great Wisconsin cheese is.
I heard that.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about some misconceptions about Wisconsin cheese? I, for one, was shocked to hear that the average number of cows on a Wisconsin farm is less than 100. I don't know. I thought they were bigger.
Yeah, you know, Wisconsin, you know, for cheddar, first of all, is really an important state, obviously. You know, Wisconsin, I've had a lot of interest in this book in Wisconsin radio and not food shows, but just, you know, people in Wisconsin, they love cheddar. They love cheddar. But, you know, they have 60 different cheddar makers just in Wisconsin.
And are those master cheese makers or just...
Not sure how many of those are master cheesemakers. I know there's that many plants. I think many of them are master cheesemakers for sure. But you know, it's you know, Wisconsin, when it lost the kind of fluid dairy battle to California, which, by the way, California averages 850 cows per dairy.
I know. That's shocking.
Yeah, and the U.S. average is 175 or 172, something like that. So, you know, it just shows the disparity in size of the farm. Sorry, my schnauzer's a little upset at something.
About Wisconsin, no doubt.
But you know... Okay. You know, this is live radio right here. Here you
go. Exactly. We've got dogs.
Somebody knocked on the door and the schnauzer's going crazy. But the Wisconsin, you know, when it kind of lost the fluid milk battle to California, it really, you know, I mean, it's not like a state makes this decision, but, you know, many dairy farmers figured out that to survive, they're really going to have to make, for, you know, lack of a better term, or use the, you know, general industry term, more specialty cheese. And not just block cheddar anymore.
Okay.
I mean, before something in the book that I like to call the cheddar apocalypse, you know, there were all these big companies like Kraft or whoever were had these whole regional networks of cheesemakers. And, you know, you can make a living making just 40-pound blocks of cheddar and shipping them off to Kraft or Armour or whoever. And then at some point, you know, those companies, as companies do, expand and consolidate. And many cheddar makers were just given very little notice and told, you know what, we don't need your cheddar anymore. There's only so much cheddar you can sell. And I think Wisconsin, in order to be the dairy is so important to the state, mm-hmm. Really made, Wisconsin farmers really made smart decisions about, keeping their farm size small mm-hmm. and making interesting cheeses mm-hmm. and using that as a way to stay mm-hmm. in the cheese business and still produce the most cheese in the country.
So they got more artisanal as the decades went by.
Yeah, well, this is specifically in the last couple of decades, and I'd say there's both more artisanal and also more supermarket specialty as well. Uh-huh. I don't want to mm-hmm. create this picture where it's like everybody just went and started making, Rush Creek. I mean, somebody
a lot
started
of people
Rush
made
Creek,
Chipotle
but, you know, a lot
cheddar.
Of other people make, flavored cheeses like that, but they mm-hmm. definitely couldn't make a living anymore making just 40-pound blocks.
Okay. Yeah, so, because, even when ACS met in Wisconsin, that was really helpful to broaden my knowledge and opinion of what was going on in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So your book just adds to the knowledge about what a great dairy state and cheese state Wisconsin is.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's great. It's great visiting there. I mean, I just did a bus tour of cheddar factories mm-hmm. a couple weeks ago, and I cheese. People live cheese there in a way that they just don't anywhere else
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
in the U.S. at least.
Okay. Now I have another question that I'm embarrassed to ask because I should know the answer, but I really feel there are a couple of different answers to this question. What is cheddaring?
Oh, what is cheddaring?
What is cheddaring? Not cheddar.
It's funny because one of the things in the book that I really realized is. It's when you say, what is cheddar, different people have different answers.
Yes.
And there's people who will say, well, okay, first of all, it's not real cheddar unless it's, made in England and the south of England in a specific mm-hmm. region and made, on a farm, right?
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, we're kind of long past that
right.
that point.
Right.
has a protected designation of origin, that, West Country farmhouse cheddar.
Right.
But there's obviously a lot of other cheddar out there. But, when I was talking to people would really have these different dividing lines.
Yes.
Some people would say, if you don't mill the curds,
right.
Then it's
right.
not really cheddar.
Right.
If you don't actually cheddar, which is basically stacking the
right.
slabs of curds
right.
on top of each other to
right.
Exude moisture, to make it so you can, this is one of the fundamental things of cheddar that made
right.
it be able to become an industrialized product was
mm-hmm.
that you were able to get more moisture out of the cheese could age longer, you could have a quality product that wouldn't rot,
mm-hmm.
that you could also, extend the life of.
Right.
And that's kind of the secret of cheddar.
That's why
cheddaring is so important.
The purpose of cheddaring. But you
right.
know what?
But the real definition of cheddar in the United States, with the Code of Federal Regulations, is just that it's 50% by weight of solids. The milk fat is 50% by weight of solids, and the maximum moisture is 39%.
Oh, wow.
Then
anything can be cheddar.
However you choose to get there,
right?
How you get there.
Okay. Now, what I noticed, it's interesting that the name of the show is Cutting the Curds, and the cheddaring goes on right after cutting the curd, I think. So, but what
I guess I should just be a regular feature on the show.
Yes,
talking
yes,
about the book,
yes.
Then.
But anyway, so, but I see three things. Is it the piling up of those blocks? Is it the milling? Is it the pressing again after the milling? Or is it two or three of those steps?
Well, when you're referring to cheddaring in particular, it's the stacking.
Okay. Okay.
It's the stacking.
So the piling. I call that piling. Okay.
Piling, yeah.
Yeah,
and I call it slabs, and I've been corrected.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not slabs, but
you know what they look
whatever,
like.
But the cheddaring is definitely the stacking.
Okay.
That's what it's referred to in the process.
Okay.
But all those things you named are crucially important, and especially crucially important in the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
Into defining cheddar to be the way it is, to
right.
kind of differentiate it from Cheshire, or
okay.
differentiate
okay.
it from those kind of cheeses.
Well, what I want to call the slabs, they look like Tempur-Pedic pillows. Yellow.
We could call them that.
They really do.
The Tempur-Pedic pillows.
That's right. But you know, online there is some question about what exactly is cheddar. Well, cheddaring and cheddar.
Mm-hmm.
Like they call it, the cooking is the cheddaring at one website I went to. And that didn't even seem like it was in the running.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I mean, the scald, you know, is you know, the term that I generally use for that. And I'm not a cheddar maker, you know.
Right,
I mean, this is from reading a lot of cheddar things and talking to a lot of cheddar makers. But as I understand it, I mean, the scald, you know, when you heat up the curds, mm-hmm. You know, it helps. You know, I mean, all these processes, I mean, every single one that we've named here is all about exuding more whey from the curds.
Right.
And it's all about making it so you can have a longer lasting cheese. But the scald is, you know, is definitely another crucial point mm-hmm. in cheddar, and a crucial point in what made it different from cheeses that came before it.
Okay. Can you tell us the story of Dumbarton? I found that story so compelling, even though I half knew it, and I had to run out and buy some immediately. I couldn't stand it.
Well, yeah, you know, Dumbarton, made by Raleigh Cheese Company mm-hmm. in Wisconsin. You know, the family was in the cheese business for a long time, as well as in the mill calling business and other things. But, you know, they go back generations in Wisconsin. And you know, kind of what I was talking about earlier with the way that it became very hard to make a living making 40-pound cheeses, mm-hmm. Making 40-pound blocks of cheddar. I mean, if you think about it, you know, scale production, you know, you've got the Hillmar Cheese Company in California, which makes 1 million pounds of cheese a day. And they knock out, you know, 640-pound blocks, you know, mm-hmm. Of cheddar and other cheeses. And, you know, they can afford to make a penny a pound and still make a pretty good living.
Right.
You know, your cheesemaker like the Raleighs, they can't make a penny a pound on their cheddar and survive.
Mm-hmm.
So while Chris was off in school, his family decided to shut down the cheddar factory mm-hmm. and shut down the cheese factory because they kind of just didn't want to. They were like seeing the writing on the wall, and they didn't want to consign, you know, Chris to a you know, hopeless life of poverty.
Uh-huh. About what year was that?
They would be, you know. So, but he came back, and you know, the family still had the mill calling business. They're still involved in dairy, but you know, he had the cheese making itch, so he kind of secretly experimented around. You know, they started making some cheese again. They, you know, it's kind of a long story, but basically, you know, he experimented around in secret with making this cheese, which is basically, you know, a traditional cheddar, you know, cloth-bound cheddar, but with blue introduced into it
mm-hmm.
On purpose. And, you know, we've all had those great wheels of Montgomery cheddar or something like that, where the Piscolini or something, where, you know, the rind cracks and you get that bluing, and mm-hmm. it's a great treat, even though it's not intentional.
Right.
But the difference in making it intentional was really creating pretty much a new cheese, at least a new cheese for the American market, and a great new cheese. I mean, it's a mm-hmm. great combination. You know, it's something that you know, I tasted and was immediately like, oh yeah, that's an amazing cheese. But he kind of had to do it in secret because, you know, the outlook seemed so bad for cheese making that the family just wanted to get out of the business. But you know, you got that multi-generational cheese making itch. I guess you just couldn't stop it.
Yeah, it's sort of the best of both worlds, and someone who doesn't love cheddar or doesn't love blue might indeed love Dumbarton.
I think that's absolutely
true. You know,
true.
It's really like, it's a cross and it's mellow.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't offend at all. It delights.
No, absolutely. And it's one of those ones that, I mean, I served it, I tell the story in the book, but, you know, I served it for, you know, pre-Thanksgiving dinner at my parents' house, and
mm-hmm.
I hadn't tasted it. I just got, you know, it was a free sample that somebody sent me. Then mm-hmm. you know, I was like, okay, I'll just bring this to my parents' house. And I know cheesemongers out there are identifying with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, it's I brought it over there. I didn't know what to expect, and I mean, people loved it. I mean, my family aren't the most adventurous cheese eaters. You
mm-hmm.
know, my dad likes really strong cheeses because he grew up in a kind of German eating family. But the rest of my family, you know, they don't really like a lot of blues. They don't really like a lot of strong cheeses. And but boy, that one, instead of being the last one left on the plate, was like the first one gone. So it was definitely, I was like, not only do I like this, I can see people are going to like this.
And,
you know,
and probably a more wide variety at family Thanksgiving than your usual cheesemongers. Wide variety at your house, at your home, than your, you know, typical cheesemonger.
Well, you know, I think that the rule for holidays is always, okay, what didn't sell? Like, I'm bringing it over to my parents. But but I can't bring over, like, 5 wash-dried cheeses. That won't
right,
go over very
right,
well.
Right. Okay, I have a few more questions.
Okay.
How did your politics inform your mission with this book at first?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I feel like, I didn't set out for it to have a specific political message. I think that there's always some things that I see in the cheese world that that are things that I note, at least.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of those is, you know, what's the relation between urban... it's this thing. We live in this very divided country politically.
Yes.
And we have, our food is made in rural areas, and our, you know, the high-end food is getting sold in, you know, upscale cities.
Right.
You know, and I was like, how does this all work together? You know,
yeah.
And that's always been a thing I've been interested in. The other aspect, I think, is that, I've always seen a parallel between living in a city like San Francisco, which is, you know, being rapidly gentrified and incredibly mm-hmm. gentrified. So as, you know, many people who I work with have, you know, lost their apartments and had to move out of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those people, you know, we probably lose more people at our store in terms of turnover for people who've been evicted and have to move
mm-hmm.
than we do because they choose to take another job in the Bay Area.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so I see that, and then I see a parallel, I don't know if other people do, but I see a parallel between that. And when you talk to a number of farmers out there, especially long-term farmers and cheese, you know, dairy farmers, cheesemakers, who are in areas who now have the sprawl has kind of arrived at their back door.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden people who are new to the area start complaining about manure smells or other things
mm-hmm.
like that. And I always think those things are worth exploring. You know, where's the things that we have in common? What can we you know, say about these things that we might have in common that we might not think about?
Mm-hmm.
I've also, you know, on the other hand of the argument, you know, I think there's always this this foodie impulse to say, you know, oh, you should pay more for food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I work at a store that, you know, is committed to, you know, we sell high-end stuff, but, you know, we're committed to serving everybody in San Francisco
right.
and also having lower-cost options.
Mm-hmm.
And so
you
just
want people
telling,
to be able to
telling
eat.
Someone who can barely afford, you know, to live in their apartment,
mm-hmm.
You know, that they should be spending more on cheese, otherwise they're a bad person, is,
mm-hmm.
you know, just not going to fly.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always interested in exploring that, mm-hmm. that dichotomy.
Okay. I have another political question, a little bit different. How were your politics challenged by what you discovered?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't view my politics as a never-changing thing. I mean, I feel like a lot of this was about... you know, examining this and stuff
mm-hmm.
that I don't know about. I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of aspects of this book that I had to learn, you know,
mm-hmm.
You know, I think the cheddar make process being one of them. I mean, I had a general idea, but,
right.
but, you know, but there's a lot of things in terms of, you know, I don't know. I think that the most challenging thing is over and over again. It's what I mentioned in the answer to the last question. But isn't the urban rural divide and
mm-hmm.
And trying to translate what you think and what makes sense in a city to the ways that people who don't live in cities, you know, with things that make sense to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about like social issues here. I mean like, you know,
survival.
Survival.
Mm-hmm.
And you know
mm-hmm.
we have. You know, we have many things in common, and we have some things that are different.
Right.
And you know, to me, that's always challenging because the stakes are high. You know, it's
yeah.
We're talking about both of our survivals, and you know, not to be all preachy, but I think that you know that we have to figure out in this country a way for those bridges to be, you know, for those gaps to be bridged
mm-hmm.
because you know, there's, you know, we got some serious issues. You know,
yeah, we certainly do.
And I think that you know. You know, my job, you know, day to day is to sell cheese. My my, you know, overall, like, moral issue is to figure out a way that helps, you know, urban people survive and helps rural people survive. And and I think that learning more about this kind of, you know, these kind of histories of, like, you know, why did people choose to get, you know, we can romanticize, you know, the small production, family farm, artisan cheese making, you know, but why did people make the decisions to go away from that? You know, some people made them willingly and some people did not.
Right.
But but, you know, understanding those things just makes us smarter about it.
And it's ideas like that that make your book really good.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, thank you for being on the show. Gordon Edgar, author of Cheddar, with its both its pre-title and subtitle. And I'll be thank you also to Liz Smith for engineering the show and John Burt for my cheese song. And thank you, Gordon. It's been great to talk to you again.
It's a great. I love that cheese song too. I was humming it to myself with it. So that was great. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.